Blog Talk Radio.
To see it, friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today and where we think the world is going, and we're not afraid to take a pretty contrarian view on those matters. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. In fact, we believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. Moreover, we believe that something's going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm coming to you live not from Las Vegas, Nevada, but from someplace much less interesting this evening, Highlands Ranch, Colorado. And with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Well, don't down your hometown, Phil. I almost did last week, and I felt bad about it, and now I'm going to pay penance by writing a post at The Speculist about Shreveport, I think. So.
Oh, okay. I think that's a good idea. Yeah, Shreveport you shouldn't diss, but Highlands Ranch, everybody who lives here talks bad about it, so it's okay. We're kind of the butt of the Denver metro area jokes. In fact, what they say about Highlands Ranch is, the line I've heard is, Highlands Ranch is where married people go to die.
it's not one of the cooler suburbs then, I guess, huh?
Well, I don't know that cool and suburb ever go together all that well, but it's one of the more suburby kind of suburbs for sure. So, yeah, cool definitely doesn't apply to Highlands Ranch. But it's a great place, and I've got terrific access to mountain biking trails. So, you know, I don't really
Well, that's cool. There's nothing uncool about that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's good stuff.
Yeah.
But last week we had kind of glanced over Shreveport, and I know that you probably, if you look into it or if you have a moment to reflect, and I'm not putting you on the spot tonight because I know you said you want to write a blog post about it, but you probably have a lot more exciting stuff to say about Shreveport.
Oh yeah, Shreveport is not a bad town. It's one of these places where you can get any place that you like within the city in 20 minutes, and no joke. I mean, there's it's like we overbuilt for interstates and things, and I mean, there's never any traffic hardly, except for maybe at 5 o'clock on the interstate. I mean, you can just about any time you can get anywhere you need to go, and it's a small enough town to where, you know, it's not overwhelming, but at the same time it has, you know, it has a lot of the big town things about it. So there's a lot to be said for my hometown. So anyway.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I mean, you know, somewhere where you get some of the advantages of the big city, but you don't have the hassles of the big city.
That's right.
You don't have the crime and the risks and the danger. Good place to raise kids.
That is right. That is right.
So you're going all out in that front.
That's right. Well, I understand you're taking on a new workout routine. And
yeah, well, I was saying before the show started, I'm feeling a little fried right now. I found this workout on the website of Timothy Ferris, who I don't know if we've talked about him in a while, if at all, but he's the guy who wrote the 4-Hour Work Week, and he is the guy who has a very unique view of how we ought to be living our lives, and one of his big ideas is that you outsource your life. You start a little business on the web that starts generating income for you, and then you can go off and do whatever is fun for you. And in his case, he likes to go off and race cars and win martial arts contests. And I don't know, like I think he won a big tango contest down in Brazil or something like that. But it was just really interesting life.
Very interesting life for this guy.
It's a very interesting life this guy's leading and not working, right? He's working 4 hours a week tops to support the lifestyle. So a big piece that goes along with this philosophy of working 4 hours a week is these super productive approaches to solving problems that we often take a long time to solve. He talks about learning a language in a very short period of time, becoming fluent in a language in 3 to 6 months. And he has an article in there about how you can basically get the feel for and sort of deconstruct any foreign language in, I think he says, like 2 hours or 3 hours or something like that. So this really outrageous approach to it's taking like a shortcut to anything you want to do. So all that's to say, I found this workout referenced on there. He's got some great diet tips on there. He's all about, you know, lose the weight fast, keep it off forever, and all about ways to get in shape really fast. And there was an article on his blog, we'll link this, talking about a workout that actually has its origins in research that was done at Colorado State University back in the 70s. And it's all about very high-intensity weightlifting. So you're actually not, in my case anyway, you're not working out with that much weight, but you're doing very slow reps, and you're just keeping at it until you just can't take it anymore. So each rep... five to 10 seconds to complete. So you're moving the bar really slow. And
looks like we might have Michael. I want to check on and see if this is Michael. Here? I'm sorry, Michael. Go ahead. Is that you?
No, this is Mark from Los Angeles. I have questions and comments. Yeah, first of all, this is regarding World Wide Web, correct? Regarding internet, correct? It's your show, right?
Well, we haven't come to that topic yet, but that's what we're going to be talking about, absolutely. So what's your question?
I have comments that you know that they're going to close down internet because they don't want truth spread out, and then they're going to go to internet too. And internet too is like a package, like your cable. If you want 15 channels, you pay $20. You want 40 channels, you pay $30, and it goes up to $100. So if you want uncensored version of internet too, you have to pay up to 100 plus packages in order to listen to Blog Talk or your radio show, etc. Or basically, they are also censoring many patriotic show as well. So what do you think of that? Is that justice or is that
normal? Well, Mark,
I'm sorry,
your name was Mark?
Yes.
Who are you talking about that's doing the censorship and that is adding these restrictions on web use and charging?
No, very soon. Their plan is to take down internet. Right now we have.
Okay. Who's planning this?
Who's planning the government? The CIA, the MI5, MI6. And how many more? I mean, KGB. I mean, all the elite, all the oligarchy people, all the elite that are together in this mess they created for us to cause havoc and distress for all of us. And basically, internet will be shut down sooner or later. And you know that they're going to call martial law sooner or later in this country. And then they are going to shut down cell phones. They are going to, then the only best you have to your walkie-talkie. If you have walkie-talkie, then you're okay.
Mark, I'm going to get to the subject of censorship just a little later on in the show. Phil, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, I was just going to say, thanks very much for the call, Mark. Appreciate you calling in, and we will come back around to censorship. I would just say that it seems unlikely to me that the government would do that, even if you had the government making a big power play, such as what I think Mark is suggesting, even if the government was attempting a big crackdown and trying to take power, simply because there's so much about us they could learn by keeping the internet going. It seems to me they would want there to be a lot of access to the internet just so they could keep spying on us if for no other reason. So I think maybe that's probably not a thing to worry about. And I don't expect we'll see the kinds of the kinds of crackdowns that that Mark is talking about. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I think you know, obviously, China has tried to make the internet work with a censorship model, and you know, because of their vast marketplace and everything, they've even got some companies to go along with it. But ultimately, I think that the countries that are the most open with the internet tend to benefit the most from it. And that's, I guess it just kind of goes along with open society as a whole. That you know, you benefit most from globalization when your society is open. And I think that the same could be said of if internet is wide open as well. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree, and I think that there are tremendous economic benefits that a society reaps from being open that they can't possibly have when they close down in that manner. I'm seeing in the chat room that they're getting an echo from me, so I'm going to Stephen. I'm going to hang up and call back in.
Okay, that sounds fine.
Now would be a great time for you to practice your singing for just a moment.
That sounds great. Well, I'd like to recommend to the audience a novel I've been reading over the last few days, and it's a quick read and a good read. It's The Great Train Robbery. Now, this thing is an old book. I mean, I've had it for a long time on my shelf. It was published in about 1974, I think, but picked it up and got into it, and I tell you, that thing read fast, and it's a reminder to me how good Michael Crichton is, especially his early career. And I've enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Read it in about one sitting, which is a little unusual for me. I usually pick up a book and read two or three chapters and then come back to it later on, but not this one. Went straight through it. All right. Maybe we can get back into Phil's conversation on his workout shortly. In the chat room, I just wanted to ask, is anybody getting an echo from my line? Yeah, David Ray responds that the movie was good, the Great Train Robbery. I have never seen that. That was a Sean Connery movie, I understand, and I think even Michael Crichton, the author, was involved in that. I mean, he might have even been the director. All right. Okay, we got Phil back. Hey,
I
Phil.
Okay. For that. I hope it sounds better now.
Good. I was just telling the audience about a book I read this week, The Great Train Robbery. And
okay.
Michael Crichton's, it's an old book. I mean, this thing been out since 1974 or something like that. And I mean, that thing I just read through that thing in like one sitting, which is unusual. So I can recommend that one to anybody.
So that would have been one of Crichton's first books.
Absolutely. It was before he was really a confirmed sci-fi author, because it's not sci-fi at all. And
right. Well, Crichton's in this interesting place because he writes these technological thrillers, biological technological thrillers. And at some point he made the leap into pure science fiction. But he doesn't describe it that way, and it seems like the publishers don't describe it that way either. He's kind of carved out this unique niche for himself. So he can write a book about time travel, like Timeline,
right,
and it's not considered a science fiction novel, which is hilarious. Or, you know, a book like Jurassic Park, for crying out loud, which
anybody
else wrote that.
Maybe he thinks of them somehow as like a techno thriller or something, and if you're defining it that way, I suppose Great Train Robbery could even fit into that, because, you know, it's these guys are using the technology of their day to accomplish this robbery, and the intricate planning that goes into it. He's a big admirer of great plans, you know, and how they come together.
Yeah, how they can be carried out. Yeah, absolutely, and how they can go wrong.
That's
right.
I noticed that in Congo as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a key thing in all of his books is the best laid plans. There's a lot of echoes of Nicholas Nassim Taleb and his book on the Black Swan and the unexpected thing that throws everything off and that you couldn't predict and that completely changes the course of everything. A book that's proved to be quite prescient, I guess, with the things that have happened in the financial world over the last few weeks. And I think that idea, he doesn't express it as such, but that idea is a big driver behind what you see in Crichton's fiction.
Right. Well, we were talking about your workout, though, and I'm sorry I interrupted you, but
we're just saying that it's Fast Forward Radio, Blog Talk Radio Network. We're going to be talking a little bit about the role of the Internet in the future, if you'd like to join us. There is an online chat, or you can give us a call, 347-215-8972. Yeah, I was just saying about that workout that it's extremely intense. It catches up with you, in my case, on about the – I'm doing these very slow reps. They probably take about, I don't know, somewhere in the vicinity of six to seven seconds to complete. And you do the first three, and you think, well, this isn't hard. This isn't much weight. And you get to that fourth one, and it's like suddenly your arms start to hurt. And then you get to that last one, and it's like, agony. And, I'm in a bit of pain right now, I have to say. Not like it hurts, but like, you know that feeling where you know tomorrow it's going to hurt?
Yeah. When you get out of bed, it's gonna be a struggle. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I've got a little of that going on. Well, and I know that you had undertaken some serious weightlifting earlier in the year. Is that still part of your weekly or daily routine? And how's that going?
I have to confess that it's not. And here's what happened. I overdid it and pulled a muscle in my back about a month or two ago. And I had to lay out for a period of time. I probably should have kept the routine of going to the gym and done some cardio or something, because when it is proved to be difficult. And I'm fine now, but I have yet to reestablish the routine of going in. So I should have never stopped completely. I should have moved to something that, you know, I could have continued to do, and so that's a lesson for me.
I mean, when you pull your back out, that is like a world class excuse not to have to work out. I mean, you get much better than that, right?
It's hard to get
back into it once you've taken a breather like that. But anyway, if you look it up, you might want to try this. You might want to try this high intensity thing. It doesn't take much time, and you can do it only once or twice a week, and the results are quite supposedly just outrageous. So we can track with this over the next few weeks if I try.
Absolutely, I want to hear next week. How hard it was to get out of bed Monday morning.
Absolutely.
You and I have reached the age, Phil, where that is something to think about. So.
Right, absolutely. Well, but on the other hand, 46 is the new 19 is what I always like to say.
That's right.
All about life extension. All right, so let's get into our topic of the evening, which is the social singularity. And I had seen, and the role of the Internet in the future, and I had seen this article on the idea of a social singularity actually was linked from Glenn Reynolds' side, from InstaPundit, and the publication is called Atlantic Free Press, which I think is really interesting that their tagline is "Hard Truths for Hard Times," and yet this writer Warren Bonesteel has come up with this, I think, very positive view of what's happening with the Internet and how it is changing the world. He's describing a world in which people obviously have this tremendous channel of communicating with each other, but beyond that, are empowered to do new things, empowered to do things that they could never do before, and to make a difference in ways they couldn't do before, to impact outcomes in ways that they didn't have the capability, and to actually band together, find strength in numbers. And one of the cites, or I should say sources he links in talking about all this is Glenn's book, An Army of Davids, which we've talked about frequently on this program as a kind of a foundational principle for how the world is fundamentally changing, in that individuals are being empowered, individuals are taking economic control, they're taking control over their own lives, they're taking control of the political process, and enjoying more autonomy in this day and age than really anything that we've ever seen in any period prior to this in human history. And what Bonestell is talking about here is how the internet has enabled this. The internet, and of course, especially the World Wide Web, has made this possible, and is making this possible. And it's just it's a tremendously uplifting kind of a read. I got through it once and I said, well, this guy is just right up our alley. In fact, I can't help but think that there's some kind of tie-in between this social singularity, this use of this technology to make people able to improve their world. And I should mention, that's one of the things that he says. People are able to come together with this idea that they can make the world better. That they have the idea that they want to do that, and suddenly they're connecting to other people who want to do that and finding ways to do that. And I can't help but think that there's a real connection between that and what we talk about when we talk about the human imperative, what we talk about in the Speculist Manifesto of humanity striving, from our inception, since the beginning of humanity, to make the world a better place, to optimize the configuration of atoms in our world, you might say, to provide better outcomes. And the internet in this model becomes a tremendous enabling technology for getting the world better and better. And as the web grows, as on the one hand the number of people using it increases, and as the technology that it supports, the different kinds of applications and what we're able to do on the internet, as that increases, you see this kind of exponential growth in terms of how people are enabled, how people are empowered, and what they're able to do because of this technology. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I had the link to the cached version of this. Apparently, Instapundit's link and probably other people linking to this have pulled it, have killed it for right now.
I shut him down for the time being.
Shut him down. But I linked to the cached version that I found at Yahoo, and it's that's how I had to find it to read it. And it's great.
Why don't you go ahead and put that link of the cached version up on the chat room so there's
I sure did. I just did. So
okay.
Everybody can take a look at that. I wonder what kind of where he thinks this is going, because I mean I certainly understand how powerful the web is right now. I mean if there's something I don't know that I need to know to accomplish anything or write about something or gain some expertise in something, I can quickly find it with the present web. But I don't think he's talking about that. I think he's talking about people banding together in, real time to accomplish, things to make the world a better place. I'm not sure if that structure has been built yet. I see efforts like on Facebook and things like that to, release so-and-so political prisoner or something like that, join my group. Well, you join that group, and the group builds to a big size, but I'm not sure how that, at this point, pushes the, to accomplish that thing that they're that these people are interested in having happen.
I think that raises a great point. That is exactly where I wanted to go with talking about this. Let's look at the internet, and we're optimists. I mean, we tend to think things are getting better. We write a regular column on that subject on the web. But the question is he right? Is the web enabling us to improve the human condition? And if so, how is it? And I think you raise a really good point. You talk about the kinds of the kinds of causes you might see on a Facebook, or that you might somebody might email you. I get a regular email from a group that's concerned about Darfur.
Yeah.
I had contributed the money to a cause around that probably 3-4 years ago, and I get continuous, like daily or maybe not daily, but certainly weekly updates from this group as to how dire the situation is and how additional money would be appreciated. You know, so it's like the institution has taken on a life, and the web certainly has enabled people to organize around things. But the question is, has it enabled people to take that next step of actually do anything about anything? Right. That's that's the real trick.
Right.
I don't see that Darfur has improved drastically over the last few years, and if improvements have been made, I'm very sorry to say that probably this group and all the other web groups working together probably haven't had that much to do with it. So from a standpoint of solving, of sweeping in and solving big, major global problems like this, maybe we're not there yet.
Are you familiar with Five for Fighting and his song, What Kind of World Do You Want?
I'm familiar with Five for Fighting, but no, I don't know that song.
Okay. He came out with a song a couple of years ago, and I've got a sample of it. I'm going to play it here in just a second. But what was kind of cool is that after he, you know, published this song, he started a website. And anyway, let me play the song, and then we'll get into what he's trying to accomplish with that, okay?
Okay.
Printed on the box I see, Acme's built a world to be. Take a chance, grab a piece, help me to believe it. What kind of world do you want? Think anything. Let's start at the start. Build a masterpiece.
Okay, I mean, so what he's doing at this website is he's saying, okay, without any preconceptions, what kind of things need to happen in this world to make it a better world? I want your suggestions. And then he takes these suggestions and starts charities that fall under the rubric of this What Kind of World, you know, .com that he started here. And I think it's a marvelous idea. So far, It's not huge yet, but I mean, I think he's raised $250,000 for various ideas and various charities that he through this website.
Not
so
bad, you know. I mean,
it's not bad.
That's a definite start. And is this something he's doing over the? I assume over the web, or it wouldn't have come up.
That's right. Absolutely.
And is it a Facebook page? We're getting some interesting discussion in the chat room about the efficacy of Facebook and social networks generally. How did you learn about it? Was it through Facebook or some of the?
No, I like Five for Fighting. I like his music, and somehow through reading about it or something, I learned about this website. And so yeah, let me pull it up and put the link in the chat room. Yeah, I like the idea of, okay, throw out your ideas if we look at them together and decide they're any good, then that will be something we try to pursue. And grab in the song, he says, grab a piece. In other words, just grab an idea and you go with this idea. You know, so it's an interesting concept, and I wish him well.
I like the idea very much, and it's great to see somebody using there, and not to say that celebrities don't do this quite a bit, because actually you do hear and see quite a bit of this, but the notoriety that they have and the what's the word I'm looking for, the kind of sway that they hold over other people due to the fact that they're celebrity, to channel that in a good direction, to channel that in the direction of helping people. And not only that, but he's empowering people by saying, let me put resources behind your good idea, right? not just I've got a great idea, now everybody get behind my great idea, but let me put some resources behind the idea that you've had. So, in fact, he is helping to empower a wide variety of causes and individuals by putting something like that in place.
That's right. The website's whatkindofworlddoyouwant.com. So,
whatkindofworlddoyouwant.com. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I would urge everyone to check that out. Let's start thinking about what kind of, you know, we talk about that quite a bit on this program, what kind of a world we want.
Yeah.
And this program, by the way, is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about the internet and the social singularity, the future of the web, and how it is perhaps making the world a better place. If you have some thoughts on that, please join us in our online chat or give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, one of the things that Steele talks about, it comes back to an idea that that we've hit on a number of times on this program, is the what the future of currency is. And we talk about currency being based not on what is the term that we usually I'm trying to think of the basic value factor that it's been suggested will lie behind the currency of the future, and I can't think of the words. But
the currency in that Living in the Magic Kingdom. What was the name of that short story? They called it Woofy.
Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom.
Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And
yeah,
they it was called Woofy, and it was based on reputation. If
reputation.
If the idea was that if I'm well known for knowing, say, Louisiana law and futurism, two very diverse things. Okay, I gain a reputation for those things. Then I can spend that reputation earns me, I guess, points in this whoopee system, whatever it is, and I can use that I can take that down to McDonald's and it'll buy a Happy Meal. You know, I kind of have tended to laugh at those ideas just a little bit, because it seems to me that reputation is built into the currency that we have now. If I don't have a good reputation as, say, an attorney, which is what I do for a living, then, you know, it definitely will affect my bottom line. But, you know, you pointed out last week that the currency we have now, I mean, you know, it's possible for a person to be born into this world, inherit a bunch of money, be a trust fund baby all their life, never accomplish anything of worth, but have a lot of money.
Right.
You know,
so where does reputation fit in there?
Yeah.
They can have, you can be Paris Hilton, right? You can have her reputation. Oddly, though, it's worth quite a bit of money. Maybe you and I are old-fashioned. We're old school. We use the word reputation to mean that people think good of you, right? Maybe.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe reputation just means that people think about you a lot in this world.
Famous for being famous.
Has bought her quite a bit of reputation. Well, I like the word that Bonesteel uses. He does not use reputation, and I was going to say this word, but I'm glad we clarified that with reputation. The word he uses is credibility.
Right.
And I think that might come a little closer. Although it's a combination of those two things. If you look at what Five for Fighting is doing, he is lending both his reputation and his credibility. But when the rubber hits the road, right, what's happening is people are giving money.
Yeah.
So I think at best, in the world we're in right now, we have a couple of currencies. There's the real one, which is that, if you have money, you can buy things and do things and make things happen. And then there's reputation, which maybe can get you some money. In which case, you can buy things, do things, and make things.
I suppose if you spend enough money, you can make a reputation by just spending money sometimes in the form of advertisement.
Well,
I guess
Paris Hilton, right? I mean, you know, she's famous for being famous, and I think the wealth is really what she was able to leverage into that, and the Hilton name. So there's an interesting, and I think complex relationship amongst credibility, relationship, and value that hasn't quite settled out yet. So let's look at some of these other questions that I had. So I think we're ready to say that that if the web enables improvement of the human condition, it doesn't do so by solving massive global problems, at least not so far. But it definitely does, to the extent that it empowers individuals and groups. It puts people in touch with each other, and it gives them more options than they've had before. How about this question? Does it bring us together as a global civilization? Is that just a loaded question, or is there really something going on there?
Oh, I believe it does. I believe that the world has shrunk in many ways. It wouldn't really matter. Let's say if somebody had something, had an interest in futurism, and came across our website, it wouldn't matter necessarily where they are. They could read our ideas and then hear Fast Forward Radio or whatever from wherever it is that they are, and then they could get involved, start commenting, asked to write a post, and we put it up on the blog. It's entirely, geography matters very little anymore. Can you imagine trying to put together a radio show with a guy in Denver and a guy in Shreveport that have basically no equipment at all and no access to a radio network or anything? Can you imagine trying to do that 10 or 15 years ago?
No, I can't. Well, it couldn't have happened anyway, because you and I would never have met to even start having these conversations, right? Without
exactly.
The web to connect people, we would have no podcast to speak of. I've thought about that in my own life, how different my life would be if this technology wasn't here. I'd be interested in the same things, but so many people I'm in contact with, so many friends I've made, and so many channels I have for not only learning about what I'm interested in, but expressing my own views on what I'm interested in, just wouldn't exist. A huge part of my life just wouldn't be there. I don't know what would be in its place. I assume I would be, like publishing some mimeograph newsletter or something like that in lieu of doing a blog. But that's not as good, and I don't think I would that we would enjoy the kinds of connections to other people that we have, but for the technology being there, much less be able to do something like this every week.
That's right. I liked what David Ray said in the chat room. Maybe Google Rank is a contemporary form of Woofy. I like that. I think that's exactly right.
Let me tell you why that is exactly right. Not only because the Google Rank is going to bring traffic to your site, so you're going to get more reputation and more credibility and more recognition, but also because the Google Rank has everything to do with how much you're paid when people click on one of your Google ads, and so the money side of currency also comes into play there. So the fact that we haven't gone to a pure reputation-based economy yet doesn't matter where Google Rank is concerned. It's driving both kinds. It's driving both your reputation and your economic viability as a website. So, good call, Dave.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, what about other ways that
there's a company called Crayon, and I'm a little fuzzy on exactly what it is they do, but Crayon, they pretty much don't have a central office, or if they do, it's not really what their business is about. They hire people all over the world. If you have an ability to do a certain task, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, you can join their company. And I think that's a model for how things are, how things could go in the future. It's a combination of the old way of doing things, within a company, but it's also the new way where people just gather together and almost ad hoc to get things done. And
service do they provide, or what business are they in exactly?
That's what I'm kind of fuzzy on. But I tell you what, while we're talking about it, I suppose I could look them up. But that's kind of what they do. They hire people from all over. Just by way of the internet, you do you know, certain tasks for their company, and that, and you get paid. So I mean, that's you know, it's not the it's not the charity thing. It's business.
So. Like regular work, like finding work to do for money.
Right.
And it's like contracting, different kinds of contracting projects. Maybe is it IT or broader than that? Or
yeah. And
with a name like Cran, you'd expect it to be graphic designers and artists and that sort of thing. You can't tell in this day and age. A name like that could attach to just about anything. But actually, the point remains the same, irrespective of what particular business they're in. And that reminds me of another benefit that I thought of earlier as I was going through this in my head. I was thinking about different ways that this kind of online community, this growing global community, has improved the world. I thought, can I make a case that the internet has improved the environment? That was just the one that occurred to me to ask hypothetically. And I thought, okay, well, you can always make the default case for any problem, and this goes back to Darfur, our earlier example, or any other problem you'd care to name. It has improved the environment by making information available to people, right? So the internet has improved the environment simply by making people more aware of the need to take good care of the environment. So if you're satisfied with that, great. But then I thought, that's not that good. What else can we do with that? I mean, that's good, obviously. It's important. But we're looking for that. How's the world really improved? And I think that this level of technology has killed distance. We used to talk back in the 80s about the coming death of distance. This was I worked in telecom back in those days, and this was a huge predicted thing that the distance wouldn't matter anymore because of telecommunication networks, obviously. And now we really see that happening, where in the business world, people routinely have regular and depending on your infrastructure, face-to-face meetings without anybody having to go anywhere. So we can, at the company I work for, we have conference rooms set up with nice HD TVs and cameras, and basically you can conference with any other location of the company, and it's like you're all pretty much in the same room. I mean, this technology has been around for a number of years. We used to do this back in the 80s and early 90s at the phone company I used to work for, and it was awful. I mean, you couldn't really, I mean, people's mouths didn't move with what they were saying. You'd get big drop-offs on the video portion or on the audio portion. It was just, it was quirky and distracting. But now it works pretty well. And people actually travel less. And so I would say their carbon footprint of businesses has been reduced considerably by the fact that people can have presence over the phone, through the net, and occasionally when they need to, by doing something like video teleconferencing. Although often people use something like net meeting or one of those kind of in between, you know, sort of live PowerPoint kind of presentation tools to allow a meeting to take place when people are scattered all over the world, rather than, you know, spending all the money for those airplane tickets and burning all that fuel. We just bring people together in a virtual way, and it sounds like that's what you've got with Crayon as well.
That's right, and I think that you know, when you when your company is scattered like that, I mean, you're never going to get everybody together, and you have to learn to work in ways where, you know, if you're going to have a meeting, you have to be very comfortable with doing it that way all the time. And, you know, so things like PowerPoint presentations and things like that, you just have to be very comfortable doing that. So, and I think that's likely to be the way it's going to be, to the point that, you know, people end up doing net meeting with someone that's like, you know, 10 feet away, because that's the way they work. You know, I'm at my desk, and yes, you're right across the room, but, you know, we're also talking with some guy that's, you know, halfway across the country. So, you know, this is the way we do things, you know. So.
Yeah, people text each other from cube to cube. Right?
Yeah.
People who could stand up in Prairie Dog. right? And like physically see each other eye to eye, actually like text each other cube to cube. So that, I mean, you know, that might be the downside, right? That could be the bleak potential for this technology. But I think not really. I think what it shows is that business communications, and really most communication, personal, interpersonal communication as well, we've gotten used to getting it down to the most essential message. So there was a time when people felt like they had to meet face-to-face, and then suddenly it was possible to do some business over the phone. And people got increasingly used to, I'm just dealing with a voice, but that's all right. And there was a time when you know, longer ago, when people would write letters, and that was a piece of business. Well, then email came along, and suddenly there's this aspect of using written communication to conduct business. And when you start combining them, you know, you got email to write to someone with, or if it needs to be instantaneous, you can you can do online chat, or you can text with somebody, you can pick up a phone, and you can call them. If it needs to be more elaborate, you can get everybody together on a net meeting, and you can share PowerPoints, and everyone's seeing all the same things. If it has to be extremely elaborate, you can have the cameras set up and actually be looking at the other people who are around you. But that's a lot of steps between no business at all and having to get together face-to-face. It's yeah. a lot of options that didn't exist before. And I think that I've heard it suggested that young people today are, you know, they're bereft of any real interpersonal communication in their lives because all they do is like text each other, right? They're just constantly texting their friends, and the truth is they're actually these kids are living very rich lives, full of interpersonal communication. It's just that it's taking a form that we're not used to, that they didn't have.
Well, and
before.
I think texting is just a small part. I mean, obviously these kids, you know, they get together and they have a normal life too. It's just I think it's just another piece that allows them to, you know, stay in contact more perhaps. So.
Well, absolutely. I mean, texting is the equivalent of, you know, passing notes in class. And suddenly you're able to pass notes not only to the person immediately next to you, but to all of your friends. All the time, you know, you want to talk about being empowered, right? You want to talk about having a new capability you didn't have before. In fact, yeah, I think that far from becoming isolated and alienated, which is the way that's often viewed, these kids are probably much more connected than it was possible to be before. Because, as you said, they still get together live. They still have friendships and, you know, swim meets and, you know, sleepovers and all that kind of stuff. And yet at the same time, they're also just constantly communicating with each other via chat, via text, via voicemail. They're sending each other pictures. And there's a level of interconnectedness that no one ever had before.
I graduated college in 1990, and I remember thinking when I was leaving college, I said, I'm going to lose contact with most of these people. These are great friends of mine, and I've had, you know, loads of fun with these people. They're, you know, these, and, but, you know, unless it's people I'm keeping up with on a daily basis, I'm going to lose contact with them. And to some extent, that was true for a while. And, you know, then you have sources like classmate.com and these and other social networks, and all of a sudden I'm plugged back into these people, you know. And, I mean, but, you know, I guess that's an example of how, you know, that there'll never be a period of time for people that are, you know, are in college now that they'll lose contact with their friends. I mean, you know, it's they're plugged into these social networks already. And those networks don't have to be built; they're in place. So,
yeah,
I don't see how that's that doesn't do anything but enrich your life. I don't see that as taking away at all.
Yeah, they will only lose contact with people they've decided to filter out.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, which is the actual thing? You know, David was talking earlier in the chat room about, you know, how big can Facebook scale? Well, one of the problems inside Facebook is how an individual scales it for their own use, because once you're kind of connected in one of these social networks, it's seemingly endless people asking you to be friends, and you can build a network of infinite size, and you see, well, not infinite, but outrageously enormous size, and you see people who have these huge networks, and not only the number of people, but the number of different kinds of interactions that you're having with these people.
Right.
Particularly in Facebook, where they have all this, like, you know, let's bowl, let's go bowling, let's play Texas Hold'em, you know.
Yeah.
You're now a vampire in my vampire posse. You know, this, like, bizarre stuff that shows up in Facebook. And some people they seem to just sign up for everything. You know, it's like they befriend everyone they meet, and they sign up for every opportunity. And, you eventually reach a point where either your entire life is sending out little gizmos and doodads on Facebook to people who are essentially strangers, or you start filtering. And you start saying, well, okay, these are the activities that I really enjoy, and these are the people that I really feel some serious connection with, that I want to be in touch with. And you know, that becomes the driver. But it's not different. I think it's not different from the decisions that we've all had to make. You know, when you were leaving college and you said, I'm going to lose touch with all these friends, well, I mean, you certainly could have made a concerted effort at that point to say, give me an address where mail will be forwarded to you, right? And
yeah.
And started this big letter-writing campaign to all your college buddies, or, you know, phone numbers or something like that. But that was hard to scale back in those days. So it was hard to scale up to that level of communication. And now the challenge is you have to scale back from...
Yeah, if Facebook is going to be meaningful to you at all, and, you know, if you intend to have a life outside of the Internet and you want Facebook to be meaningful to you at all, you've got to make, you know... Okay, I don't really know this person. You know, we have two friends in common, and yes, this person might be a fascinating person, but right now, you know, I'm choosing not to add them to my friends list at this point. Yeah, you just have to make those decisions so as to make it useful to you, I guess. I noticed
exactly.
Social networks like are having now where you. You have, like, friends, and then better friends, and then super-duper friends. They're like, like grades of friendship, I guess, now within these things, so that you could, I suppose.
Well, they need something like that, because there's this harsh thing of, like, defriending someone.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, nobody wants to do that. That's just the meanest thing in the world, right? But if you look at your list and you go, I've just got too many people on this list, what do I do? Well, do I make them an unfriend? Is there a big red X I can put next to their name, you know? And then if I do that, what, do they get an email that says, oh, so-and-so, you know, just like when you become friends, it was all, you know, it's published in Facebook anyway. It's on your wall, right?
Well, what you do, you make yourself a form letter, you know, it's not you, it's me.
It's me, exactly, yeah.
We're breaking up, but it's me. It's
no, but it's me.
You.
It's totally me. No, you're great.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's awkward. That's awkward. So it's like, that exemplifies what I'm saying about filtering, about the need to filter to make that useful, because otherwise you've just got this cacophony. And I mean, it's not just on the social networks. We filter anyway. We have a lot of just kind of biases that filter the information that we get. We have favorite websites that we go to. We have people who, if I get an email from one individual, I'm going to immediately read that and respond to it, and somebody else, I'm going to go, well, you know, I'll get to it, I promise. Really, I will. And that kind of guides how we interact with people via email, or how we feed ourselves information over the web. But that brings me back to my question, which is not just emphasis on global civilization, and not just emphasis on connecting individuals, but this question: is the Internet actually bringing humanity together? Are we because this is what I think Bonesteel is suggesting, very mildly, very lightly suggesting, that people are on the web becoming more of one purpose, becoming more nearly united in terms of a common set of goals. He doesn't say that, but that's what's hinted, and that's what's suggested at. And
I think
that's my question.
Okay. My thought on that is that it's hard to hate somebody that you know. I guess I should say it this way. It's easier to hate somebody that you don't know and that you haven't had conversations with. You haven't read what they've written. You haven't, you know, stepped into their shoes in some way. You can always make them the other easier as long as you have limited contacts with them. The internet makes everybody closer. I mean, if you care to know what anybody, you know, what any group of people think, you know, you can find it out on the internet. And you know, it just, I think it does. It makes hatred a harder thing to muster. You have to work at hatred harder when you know them.
Yeah.
And
now there
are always people out there willing to work at hating. You know, you're going to find people like that. I mean, they're willing to, you know, to go the distance, you know, on hatred. But it's, I think, becomes a rarer thing, and that's good.
I think you're right, and I think where it's most challenged is probably in the political arena, and certainly if you read. Well, not just there. Actually, anywhere that comments are allowed, I would say. Anywhere in the blogosphere or elsewhere in the internet where people are allowed to leave comments, because you want to talk about a technology that has enabled people. The internet has enabled people to be obnoxious to complete strangers in a scale that was never possible before. You know, I mean, you'd have to go, like, try to be rude to everyone in an entire football stadium or something like that to achieve the kind of scale that people are able to achieve. And I mean, we talk about this sometimes too. It's like a lot of times the people who show up on the blog to make a comment, as often as not, don't have something terribly constructive to say, right? They've got a chip on their shoulder about something. They've got a preconception about who you are, having written the piece that you've written, and they immediately go into their talking points against the people who they believe hold the particular position, which may or may not even apply to you. And you see this in the political blogosphere especially, where there's this kind of polarization. And I think that while the technology has enabled us to connect, and if we can get past our areas of disagreement and look at each other as start to look at each other as human beings rather than as people on the wrong side of a particular cause, I think there's great potential for it to connect us. I can't help but feel that there's also a real danger that this technology can help to make us even more polarized than we have been in the past.
It seems to me that I think that's true. I think that there are going to be people that join the liberal team and then people that join the conservative team, and you tend to throw a lot of bombs back and forth at each other more so. I mean, you know. It seemed to me like maybe 20 years ago it was easier to be an independent where, you know, let me listen to the ideas that are out there and I'll vote on that basis. Well, you know, now there seems to be more polarization. I agree on that. But,
I think it's a combination of two things. It's the filters. You can filter out and just kind of get information from the people who agree with you ideologically, combined with the highly scalable and ease of access obnoxiousness, right? You put those two things together, it's kind of this this toxic thing. But as you were saying that, it occurred to me. I think the difference is maybe that the web has opened us up to people in other countries, to people in completely different situations, and we're able to see them better, to understand them better, and we're more accepting of them as people in our lives. And the people who are closest to us in some ways, with whom we just, you know, with whom we share a common language and a common culture and common history, but with whom we disagree politically, it maybe tended to help polarize us a little bit. So it's kind of a mixed bag there, I think.
Yeah, perhaps so. I think one thing that both sides could try to keep in mind is that there's not going to be any ultimate winner. I mean, you know, you know, liberalism is not going to triumph to the point that conservatives, you know, anybody to the right on these issues is their point of view is never even considered anymore, and you know we live in a liberal utopia from now on. That's not going to happen. Nor is, you know, nor are we going to choose as a nation to elect Ronald Reagan clones from here forward. That's not going to happen either. It's going to be a back and forth, and you know, it might help to you know, to depolarize us some if people on both sides of the issue realize that, and you know, just, I don't know, try to find some middle ground every now and then.
Yeah, it's going to bounce. It's bound to.
The pendulum swings back and forth. Yeah.
Well, and I think that what I really like about what Bonesteel said, because it fits so well with what we do, is that where people are in complete agreement before they start arguing or after or alongside of the fact that they argue, is that everyone agrees that they want the world better, right? That takes us back to the human imperative and to the idea of live to see it and better all the time. We all agree that we want the world to be a better place. We might fundamentally disagree as to how we make it happen. A lot of what we want to happen is actually not that different, although there are different means of getting there. So one of the things I hope to see happen is that people get as focused on ends as means, that they start looking at positive outcomes and saying, well, you know what, I'm a real conservative guy, you're a real liberal woman. We disagree on just about everything, but we can definitely both agree that X would be a completely positive outcome. And when you look at something like Better All the Time, which we publish regularly, a list of good news stories, there's hardly anything that we've ever put on there that would appeal only to one side of the political spectrum, right?
Right.
I think that most of the stuff we put on there and most of the stuff we talk about on this program would appeal equally well to people on either side of the spectrum. They can disagree as to the, you know, political philosophy that's going to lead to these good things happening, but they'll agree on what the good things are. I think we all know what an improved world looks like when we see it.
Right.
And when we conquer
cancer, I think that there'll be a cheer from both sides of the aisle, you know.
Exactly. So I think that by allowing us to communicate our ideas about what would make a better world, to focus on the ends a little bit and to agree that we should all be working on those things, I just didn't want to end on, oh, wow, everybody disagrees, it's a mess. I want to make it clear that in my view, I believe that the technology and people using this technology are indeed eventually going to come much closer to a community of people working towards positive ends. And I think at that point you really do have something like a social singularity, a very different world than the one we live in now. But what has to happen before we get there is that people start looking for good outcomes ahead of winning. And I think that's a big leap that's going to have to be made.
Absolutely. Well, I guess it's time to close the program, Phil.
I know, I talked over. So, do we have music,
cool,
or did we already hear it from Five for Fighting?
Well, we got some additional music. This is a cover of the old disco anthem, Call Me. You might remember Blondie came out with this about
Blondie.
79.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So, I thought it was a pretty good cover. So, here it is. It's Daydream on Autopilot is the name of the band, and the song, of course, is Call Me.
Daydream on Autopilot, singing the song Call Me, which, of course, was originally from a biopic about me called American Gigolo back in the 70s. So we'll listen to that. And, Stephen, thanks for putting that together. Thanks to Michael and to all our friends in the chat room. Really appreciate all your contributions this evening, and we look forward to being with you all again very soon on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, good night.